welcome to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Burn, and with me as always is Mike Montgomery.
How's it going, Internet?
And today, it's the deep-fried end of the world! Yes, if you like your apocalypses with a nice side of fried fish and maybe a squeeze of lemon, have we got a helping heaping for you. This is a return once again to Salter Street Films, the return of Welcome to Halifax. This is DEF CON 4!
The Nemesis. A nuclear weapon space platform designed to protect America.
Roger, on my way.
It is 22,000 miles over the Earth when World War III explodes.
Can't walk.
I don't believe it.
DEFCON 2.
We have solid object alert.
All right, look, it's happening, right?
It's Jordan, it's happening.
All right, then launch, Walker. You're all getting blown away!
We'll launch, we get War One.
Walker, fight!
Do it.
The Star Wars technology of the future becomes the reality of today. Defense Condition 4. For three astronauts, the mission that began in space will have its ultimate destiny on Earth. What they will find is unthinkable.
Hey! It got hold of my hand! Hey, Walker!
What finds them is far worse. DEFCON 4. The final defense.
Oh, but before the apocalypse truly hits and the world, well, gets worse than it already is.
No, this is fine. It's great. It's fine.
Just a quick standard bit of housekeeping. If you're enjoying the show, please do not forget to hit those like buttons, share the podcast, subscribe, tell your friends about us. Word of mouth benefits us to no end. And also a quick reminder of the Coast Magazine's Best of Halifax campaign for this year, running until July 24th. You just go to vote.thecoast.ca. Take like 5 seconds to create an account to sign in. Look for the, music and culture category. And nominate Real Geeks for Best Podcast. I honestly cannot describe just how much even simply getting on the ballot would help the show.
Give us the ballot. Give us the ballot. Give us the ballot. Then steal us the vote. Steal us the vote. Steal us the vote. And if you don't give it to us, we'll just nuke it all. Just like in this wonderful offering from the Brothers Donovan. Burn it all down, burn it all down. Yes, it's the 80s, we're gonna nuke the world. I unapologetically love this film because for me personally, it is part of what I call the Fallout trilogy. And by trilogy, I mean as many goddamn films as is necessary, where essentially, if you ever played Bethesda's Fallout or the Interplay Fallouts, and you watch this movie or Mad Max, like the original and Road Warrior, or if you like A Boy and His Dog, which at some point I want to show you, even though the main character is absolutely horrible, he is a terrible person, if you like The Omega Man starring Charlton Heston, those films fall into the Fallout trilogy, kind of stuff that you can watch or read, like the original Postman novel. Fantastic book that is essentially just Fallout New Vegas. You get the same general sense of like, ooh, I love Fallout. And this is pure, pure Fallout. It is... Okay, No, we're going to run through the plot real quick.
Yeah.
There's some astronauts. They are on a secret military satellite. What do they have? Nukes! If everything goes to shit, nuke the Earth from above. It's the only way to be sure. Unfortunately, something goes wrong after about 2.5 months or so after the world ends. And suddenly their ship changes trajectory, goes into retrograde, and they come down outside. I don't know where it's supposed to be. Like, yeah. they kind of imply it might be South Africa or South America, but it's like, nah, buddy, that's like fucking Shelburne. I'm pretty sure that's Shelburne.
Yeah, I was just going to say, literally just because it was Sulphur Street Films, I just assumed that it was Atlantic Canada.
yeah. And so they come down in Atlantic Canada and immediately run into, like, typical post-apocalyptic Fallout-esque kind of characters. There's the ravenous cannibals who immediately eat the biggest dickhead on the crew. That was fun. There's a lone survivor kind of wingnut. There is his underaged. One second. There is his underaged, not a sex slave, because they don't want to directly imply that, but she's living in the floorboards and wearing a schoolgirl outfit. So.
This is post-apocalyptic Black Snake Moan.
Yeah. There is the military cult leader who has absolutely no experience or place being in charge. He just happened to survive to that point and has a ragtag group of fascist shitheads all about him. As you do, one's got to have your war boys. And from there, what you can presume occurs. A Fallout game, a typical Fallout plot, occurs. And you have to make friends with some of your enemies to overcome the bigger militaristic cult junta bastard. and not to spoil the whole thing, but to spoil the whole thing.
Yeah.
It, of course, ends as it begins. With a fucking nuke. Oh, like, for B-grade local Canadian 80s cheese, this is like brilliant, precise screenwriting. This I could completely understand and believe. So this was the second film Sulphur Street's ever made. I can completely understand and believe that, like, they made Siege / Self-Defense / whatever the fuck to get
Night Warriors
the funding... / Night Warriors to get the funding to make this, because this is a script that is so tight and just like so classic, so like pulpy. Oh, this was the film someone was dying to make.
Oh yeah, no doubt. Like this in terms of quality, just between these two films, like it is just night and day.
Yeah. Without running into, like, being too good. Like, there are no effects or weird props in this that don't make sense. Everything seems to be pretty good. There's some very interesting moments. Did you know the United States Air Force allows you to watch porn in front of your co-ed co-workers in space? Or, I guess, maybe, where are they supposed to do to stop you?
Yeah, like I was gonna say, that was probably one of the few things that I had a real issue with. Just
watching it.
It was like,
that's cool.
Yeah, it was just there. Like, I get that you're going to have scenes like that in an exploitation film, but in this case, it felt like it was just there because it's an exploitation film.
Yeah, because you can, and it's a really quick way to give the impression that just how much of a dickhead this character is, because he is dead at the 10-minute mark. He is eaten alive, and it's one of those ones that's like, wow, okay, you're committing to, like, making this world they have to survive in a true horrorscape of, like, anything could happen, and even before you step outside of the capsule, you could be murdered. And they have it occur to the biggest dickhead, who they spend a very concise and appropriate amount of time showing to be like a power mad prick, indecisive, arrogant, a pig, and just like overall rubs the entire audience the wrong way. And then they kill him.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
He's also in some ways like, of this group, he's the muscle. He's the guy that you think, like, we hate him, but we're going to need him to survive in this wasteland. And then, not too bad.
Yeah, he's Soldier Boy.
Yeah.
He's Soldier Boy. He's 100% Soldier Boy, because he's like, yo, I'll get the fucking job done, and you may not like it, but at the end of the day, it's how it gets done. And then he gets off, and all you have left is the wimpy scientist and the lady astronaut who is knocked the fuck out at the very beginning, and like spends, I want to say, a good third of this film unconscious, until like we see her again in prison.
Yeah. And then when she finally meets her fate, it's like, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah. 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 It's we'll get to,
yeah,
we'll get to that because this movie makes decisions and has some choices, but they're all, I want to feel like, appropriate ones for the setup. Even that, I love the killdozer. They built an actual killdozer for this film that makes sense, and then it gets dealt with in another way that makes sense. There's no leap in logic. It's purely just, yeah, okay, if you build a trench at the bottom of a hill, it will not be able to push through it or get back up easily. If you, while it's in that, tie it via a bunch of chains to big fucking trees, it's not going anywhere. And then you throw a grenade inside. It's so basic. It's a scenario that clearly, like, it was, you know, it's a classic war scenario of how to fuck with a tank. But applying it so well to this kind of post-apocalyptic out there fantasy, it works. It grounds it immediately in, like, this is a very realistic, very, very maritime, very realistic post-apocalyptic hellscape.
Yeah, no, like, with that ambush sequence, on the one hand, I kind of had a problem with it just because I felt like the setup and execution of it was a little too fast. But at the same time, with the tractor and how it's constructed, I almost expected, like, Mr. T, George Peppard, Dirk Benedict, and Dwight Schultz to show up. So there's that balance of, this is ridiculous, but it's such a well-done ridiculous that I can be okay with it.
See, and I kind of felt like we got that in, inevitably, Gideon's second in command, who is just kind of like a dumb prick who is high on his own militarism, but he's not even in the army. Like, I immediately, it's just like, oh yeah, yeah, no, that's that dude with the mohawk in Mad Max 2. You know, he's the secondary villain, and you gotta have a really good, memorable dickhead secondary villain, and he's a very good, memorable dickhead secondary villain. Like, he's just really punchable in the face area.
Oh yeah, no, he totally is. But also, I'm just gonna bring this in now, just because you mentioned Mad Max. Like, if you're doing like a post-apocalyptic themed movie marathon, and you're having a bunch of friends over, like you're gonna have like the Mad Maxes and so forth. But you know how you always want to try to have that one movie that perfectly fits in, but odds are none of your friends have heard of.
Mm-hmm.
This is 1,000% that movie.
This is absolutely that movie. This is just low grade in terms of production quality and like budget enough to fly under everyone's radar and guarantee a sillier frame of mind for watching, but so competently done.
Yeah.
And so bizarrely regionally zeitgeisty. Like, If you told me this was actually like an episode of the Trailer Park Boys and you replaced certain actors with Trailer Park Boy actors, and it was like, yeah. So remember that episode when they made a post-apocalyptic movie? You know, like the way that It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia made the Lethal Weapon sequels. Like, they made a movie in their show. If you told me that this was part of the Trailer Park Boys universe, I would absolutely, like, buy it. It's like, yes. Yes, absolutely. Because that's how... That's the level it's at, where it's just, yeah, I... As someone who has lived, been born, grown up, all that in Nova Scotia, can see this being the outcome at the end of the world. Because we're not going to get hit by nukes necessarily. Halifax might be if, you know, they get to the third round picks of targets. Yeah, yeah. Sure. You're fucking gone, George's Island. Sorry. But it's unlikely that we'll get to that. And even if so, you'll have people in Yarmouth. Civilization will survive in Sydney and Yarmouth, Truro and Tatamagoosh. This is the kind of fucking civilization you would get, and it's so good.
in all seriousness, though, let's be honest. If we have learned anything from, like, zombie films or post-apocalyptic anything, Nova Scotia is one of the safest places on this planet. No matter the disaster, Nova Scotia will survive.
Yeah, that's because people think we're a fucking island. You're thinking of Newfoundland, you dumb bastards. You're thinking of Newfoundland. Anyway, this reminds me a lot, years and years ago, and I do apologize because I've forgotten the artist's name, because I did look it up and then I completely spaced on it. It was called Welcome to Halifax, which, of course, I'm taking the unofficial title for this, like, series of Salter Street films. And it was, like, all of that appropriated into modern Halifax. And I still somewhere have a clipping that I saved. It was the best cartoon of it that I ever saw. And it's the main character and some guide they have. They're making their way to, like, one of the piers. I think like, to where the Discovery Center used to be or something. And just as they're about to get there, a Dragula'd out harbor hopper leaps the wave. And there's like a zombie, like a Dracula style zombie screaming on it about how the city is named for Eustace Halifax, a Viking pirate. And the main character's just like, that's not even barely true. And the other one's like, run for it. It's like, this city is fucking primed for this kind of stuff. We have just the right attitude. And this film perfectly encapsulates it. If I could have my way, there would be just a few touches to make it even more so. One, there should be more rum and cokes going around. Two, there should, like, civilization should only survive in the form of Robin's donuts. Tim Hortons, you're fucking nuked. But that Robin's attached to the SO, you know that fucking shit's still going. And they will have roll up the rim for cups for fucking years after the end of the world. Three, the headquarters should have been in a curling rink.
Well, and as long as we're listing basically Nova Scotia cliches.
Four, a bomb in a Donair. The Donair is a bomb.
Well, that just goes without saying. But another thing that I really feel like does establish the location of this movie. I don't know if you ever noticed this, but there's an awful lot of Alexander Keith's bottles in this movie.
It is beautiful. And there's stubbies.
Yeah.
Oh, she's got stubbies, boys. She's got stubbies. The moment I saw it, as they were riding the prisoners in that procession to begin, like about a third of the way into the film, and there's just a bottle of Keats in a fucking can hold, like a drink holder for this militaristic prick to enjoy. And it's like, yes. Oh God. Yes. That is the best thing ever. If they had gotten the rights at the time, and like, it would be way easier to now because it was, I believe, a functioning bottling plant at the time. But if they could have turned the Keese Brewery into like the bad guy's super fortress. Oh my God. I might have shit myself in glee.
Oh.
I demand a remake of this where the whole goddamn, like his office is overlooking just that little internal square where they have all those lovely patios.
I mean, if nothing else, I've seen Godigan Street. I've seen Spryfield. I'm sorry, but let's be honest. Recreating a post-apocalyptic wasteland around here would not be that hard.
Yeah, you just gotta get to it before you have to fucking green screen out all the goddamn high rises.
and to those of you listening from those areas, if I may quote Chris Rock, "Boo if you want, you know I'm right."
Listen, I love the North End. I love the fucking North End. I lived there for a while. Lived in the South End for a while. All in shitty shacks. And let me tell you, they are wonderful, terrific, great. And I only heard someone get into an argument over buying crack four times at max. Four times. That's not too bad. And it didn't turn violent at any time.
Like, we love you, but let's be honest.
No, the gunshots I heard were near me. Speaking of local culture, Lenore Zahn's in this. She gets top billing. She doesn't appear for about fucking 20 minutes, but she gets top billing. And it's like, yeah, way to go, Lenore. And for anyone sitting at home going, who the hell is Lenore Zahn? Number one, slap yourself right now.
Like, come on.
Do it. I'm waiting. I am waiting for the sound. Number two, you absolutely know who Lenore Zahn is because you probably grew up watching X-Men on Fox Kids.
Yeah, come on now, y'all. Sugar, you have absolutely heard of who this woman is.
Well, hey there. This is Lenore Zahn, and I am the voice of Rogue of the X-Men. The original voice. The one and only voice I hear.
And I, speaking as someone who had a chance many times to talk to Lenore Zahn in a completely professional setting as a journalist, because after Lenore had her acting career, which is reignited now thanks to Disney, she has recorded lines for the new animated X-Men here in the city. So part of X-Men Animated is recorded in Halifax now, officially. That's pretty goddamn cool. Anyway.
Yeah, once again, your favorite Marvel properties are ours.
Yes. Anyway, after she had her original like kind of like acting career, appearing in various and random roles, she became an MLA. That is a representative in our provincial legislature in Nova Scotia. So like a state house member. A state house member. And so I got a chance to talk to an X-Man over various X-Men non-related issues like funding for housing and events in Truro, Nova Scotia. And those were really fun times because, like, you can just barely withhold yourself professional level from being like, do the voice!
Yeah, and I actually had a chance to briefly talk with her at HalCon when she was there. And make no mistake, she will happily do the voice. no matter how flimsy the excuse might be. But at the same time, I do have to say, even just talking to her, like with her natural speaking voice, you can totally still hear Rogue.
It's still there. Yeah. That's good. That's nice. And no, it's true. Like, I only spoke with her, unfortunately, over the phone, so I didn't get that richness that you hear in someone's voice. But you could definitely be like, I know that voice. How do I know that voice? And yeah, wonderful person. Terrific. Tons of fun. She jumped into federal politics, held a seat with the Liberals for one term, I believe, and then got voted out due to her riding, the riding she was in turning blue. As usual, conservatives going after the fucking mutants.
Oh, yeah, no, I don't care what anybody says. Conservatives just ruin everything.
But she's pretty damn good in this this film. I like her character could have easily been nothing. Her character can be much more. It was written to like the framework of the time and such. I'm just kind of fascinated how she ended up getting top billing when, again, her character is not the main.
True, but also this is the hilarious thing, because when I was watching the movie, I guess I turned my head away from the screen at the exact wrong second, because I didn't realize she was in the movie until the end credits.
Oh my god. So you're just like, who the hell is that?
And I'm
like,
looking
clearly at her, 20 year old.
I'm looking at her like, you feel familiar. And then I see Lenore Zahn's name in the end credits, and that's when I messaged you like, so what percentage of the review is just going to be X-Men jokes?
So I guess that was about 1/6 so far. About
give or take, yeah.
Yeah, if I round that out, that'll probably come to about 1/10 to 1/12. So a decent 10 to 7.5%. That's pretty good. It's not quite CanCon, but we can get there.
Yeah.
another fun little detail. I'm pretty damn sure the schoolgirl outfit she is wearing throughout it is just from St. Mary's in the city. Like, there's one really big private Catholic school in the city that like has all the money and attention and all that. And like, if you have ever been downtown, whenever it's not summer vacation, you see these kids in these uniforms, and it's just like, it's a tiny little detail that makes it once again super like I know exactly what you're that Gideon was a kid who went to that school, and his parents were like, or his father at least was a high level government employee who would have been saved come a nuclear attack. It's like, yeah, that makes sense, because they totally would have sent their kid to that school because that's where the fucking money sends their children. It's like, it's tiny little details that like, oh god, this was written by someone who just is poking in localities, and it's gorgeous. It's not heavy-handed, but it works to build an overarching cultural feeling of the remnants of Halifax Regional Municipality.
Bugger.
Bugger!
Well, no, it's just, while you were saying that, I'm actually on Wikipedia, because I just got curious, and I wanted to see where Lenore Zahn actually went to school.
Hmm.
Apparently she graduated from the Cobequid Educational Center, a high school in Truro. And she then attended York University in Toronto, where she studied drama, fine arts, and political science. Yeah, no, I just got curious, because when you mentioned that, I got the idea of just wondering if that school jacket was, like, actually hers.
That would be hilarious.
Yeah, that
would have
been
like,
amazing.
Like, busting out everything. Bring in your costumes, kids.
But, oh my god. Yeah, and where you were wondering about how she would have gotten top billing. I think at that point, she actually might have been the actor in the movie just with the most name value.
And that makes complete sense because I don't know any of you others at all.
Maury Chaykin, I do kind of know. Like, he was never really, like, a name actor. He, I believe, was kind of half doing... He was kind of half behind the scenes, half Canada's Danny Trejo, where you wouldn't necessarily know the name, but you'll see him and it's like, yeah, that guy.
And I will admit, I completely forgot that was Maury Chaykin because he's under so much crap. Like,
yeah,
he's wearing a helmet and a stupid hat, and then, like, he's gagged with, like, a bunch of levels, like, layers of duct tape. And it's like, I did not once recognize that that is our, I think of him not as our Danny Trejo. He's kind of our James Gandolfini, but not in terms of, like, serious acting clout. More in terms of if you need someone to stand in for a gangster.
Yeah.
There's your man. He's not necessarily menacing, but he looks the part.
Yeah, no, I could totally see that. Interestingly enough, I think, aside from Lenore Zahn, the only actor working today... might actually be Kate Lynch, who played Jordan, like the doctor.
Yeah. And she was in Meatballs, and that's, in terms of Canadian culture, that's rather large.
Yeah.
We're a small pool.
But yeah, like, I'm just taking a quick look through the IMDb listing, and she, her and Lenore Zahn seem to be the only two with any credits in about the past 5 years.
Yeah, and Timothy Clark Choate of Babylon 5 was also in this, but unfortunately passed in 2004.
Yeah.
And unrecognizable, by the way, so like that's the thing. Everyone in this film is slightly unrecognizable, except for Lenore Zahn, somewhat.
Yeah.
It's a really strange film. I understand not knowing anyone from the original, from like Siege / Self Defense / Night Warriors. Night Warriors?
Yep, Night Warriors.
Night Warriors. Because none of them became very famous or successful necessarily. This one is more just a matter of really good costuming, hiding up the people that you would otherwise not recognize.
Oh yeah, no, and make no mistake, 1985 was probably a very good year for our local army surplus store.
Oh yeah, Ron's definitely sold them all of this. I remember Ron's. Ah, Ron. It was a army surplus warehouse in Burnside, Dartmouth, and the second the idiot second in command villain comes on screen, I just immediately got flashes of like the mannequins that they would have. It's like, that is $15 worth of an outfit,
yeah,
at Ron's army surplus. $12 if you can convince them to barter. And this film fucking bartered. So it was made for just over $1 million. But more importantly, it was distributed by Roger Corman's New World Pictures. So this was done on the cheap.
Yeah. Delightfully
so.
I was just going to, as soon as you bring in Roger Corman's name, it's like, that explains so much.
The Canadian saint, the greatest, I don't care. I don't care what you have to say about literally any other director. Fuck Martin Scorsese. He ain't Roger Corman.
Yeah, no, if you want it brought in on time and under budget, Roger Corman's not going to care what he has to do.
Hey, you want to make 3 movies for that budget? Yep. We can do that. We can do that. Listen, just give me 5 minutes to punch out 2 more scripts. It's called The Return and The Baby Of. Done, motherfuckers.
And those 3 movies are all the same sets, the same casts, the same wardrobe, but somehow each one is a completely different genre of film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You ever want to see a slasher film followed up by a gritty noir thriller? No? Well, too fucking bad.
And in the end, all of a sudden, it's a romantic comedy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. speaking of kind of like low budget but out there, this film, as I said earlier, it follows the standard like Fallout script. So
yeah,
we have a great like gathering of forces. At their darkest point, the bad guys have all of the good guys completely fucked. Their escape plan has been thrown out the window. Everyone's captured, and then chaos fucking ensues. And everything goes to shit very quickly in a way that, once again, as I said earlier, is very well thought out to the point of, oh, you sat there for years thinking about this, didn't you?
Oh, you know, like there's so much here that, especially on this budget, just should not work. A lot of the exterior space station shots at the start of the movie look so good that if you told me that was stock footage from a completely different film, I would believe it.
And it's a tiny thing that makes them so good, and it is so technically brilliant. A lesser production crew would have space moving slowly.
Yeah.
They, like, you get a static shot of the thing kind of floating in front of the planet. What they do is, so for cost effectiveness, they're not going to pretend that they're on low gravity. So how do you do that? Well, you spin the station on its axis. So they spin the model, and that not only gives an explanation for why you don't have to suddenly hang your actors on cables for your opening 10 minutes in every scene, but it allows you to go cheaper and low budget with the space effects because everything's fucking moving. You don't get a chance to really focus on it. And it's moving in a way that modern space thrillers like For All Mankind and that one where Sandra Bullock gets stuck in space. We know what happens. We can visualize it better. And when you move in space, Newton just shits the bed. You start fucking spinning and spinning, and it becomes really fucking disorienting. And most films did not show that because, as I just said, it's disorienting. It's really difficult to look at. But if you're trying to cover up the cost of an effect, it both makes that effect look good, but also makes it realistic. It looked like a model in front of a projected screen, but it looked like a model in front of a projected screen that was really well done and understood space physics. They really got orbital mechanics down for this B-grade film.
Oh, like, there were points where there were interior shots, but you could see windows looking out. Where you almost swear that like the set was static, but the screen behind those windows, that was spinning.
Yeah. And it's not just a mess. It's you can track it, and if you were so inclined and nerdy, you could probably time out the orbit rate and speed of the space station, because it's not just like nonsense going by. There's like, okay, we passed. That's a rotation. That's a rotation. That's a rotation. You know, it's a tiny detail in the production design that they didn't have to, at their production budget level, focus on, but they did. And it immediately starts the film off feeling, even though it's ridiculous and kind of out there, feeling realer.
Oh, yeah, and also to add to that, the use of the news broadcasts was, that was probably my favorite thing in the entire opening act.
And that was some of the best fake news broadcasts I have ever seen in a classic film. I almost suspect that they managed to get their way into like the ATV news studio to use their actual cameras on that, because there was a difference in the video quality. And it's not just like, oh, you go a little cheaper or something. No, that's not how TV worked. Film and TV signal had dramatically different color ratios, different contrasts, and you can see it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you look at something like Doctor Who from that time period, where the cameras for exterior footage and for interior footage, like set footage, were completely different. And you could see it in the quality. But here with the news broadcast, I also love just how they were used in terms of, you basically watched the world just completely disintegrate in nuclear Armageddon right along with these main characters.
And it's done so, again, so efficiently and so cheaply.
Yeah.
So you record one, maybe two news segments at most. Two news segments, but you give a sense of like gravity and scope by having them just flick through other channels, and one by one, that channel goes off. Flick to the next one. That channel goes off. Flick
slowly but surely.
One. Yeah, and it's just it's tiny, it's efficient, it's effective. It's very effective film.
Oh, you know, and anytime you don't have the budget for like big CGI or whatever, just those little things like building your story, relying on your actors, just that can do so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a great film to teach people. Like, you don't have to always rely on CGI or even like exposition. Just think about how you can creatively use a space, how you can creatively use objects. Is there an option right here, right now, with what we have, that we can better tell this story without having to go and throw a bunch of fucking money at something?
Oh, and then from pretty much the moment the station gets pulled down to Earth, the character of Hal in particular just for me just completely falls apart.
Oh, poor sad sack hero guy. Yeah, it's one of those characters that's like, okay, you're essentially supposed to be Ash, you know, from Evil Dead, you know, sad sack who gets thrown into hero position unexpectedly, and you know, manages to rise above, and he really, like, his actions do, he does not.
No, I mean, we established early on that he has, if I remember right, a sister and other family in, I think, Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And then Armageddon comes, and he accepts that his family is dead very quickly.
He has a light freak out.
Yeah, he does have a light freak out, but like that to me, just wondering what happened to his family, That's a character story that could have been used over the course of the entire movie.
Yeah, and like, you know, there could have been aspects there, but you know, it's what they really should have done is they should have positioned his family closer to Nova Scotia.
I mean,
so
yeah,
that it would make sense, because like in this hellscape, if you can't even get from like the beach to the woods without being eaten, no way in hell are you traveling from Seattle to Halifax.
No, and then pretty much every time he encounters any sort of like villainous entity, like the aforementioned cannibals or Maury Chaykin's Vinny, he rolls over and is immediately like, we have 4 months of food. You can have it all. It's like, oh,
seriously,
my
he's
God.
He's got to shut his fucking mouth about the food.
No, it's like, I'm sitting there like, do you have no survival instinct at all?
Oh, none at all. Like, he manages to negotiate out of Maury Chaykin a gun and one third of the food, and he turns and gives him another, like, portion to make sure Maury has three quarters. To which Maury Chaykin's character responds in a phrase that has become very problematic. That's quite white of you.
Oh,
it's like,
my God.
That's when you don't hear anymore.
Nope.
But yeah, like his first response in any situation is not to shoot. He has a moment when he had an assault rifle in his hand and Maury Chaykin had a shotgun pointed towards the ceiling. And it's like, just pull the trigger.
Yeah.
Just shoot him in the chest. No, he hands the guns over when Maury asks for them. Lenore goes back into the basement and he allows himself to be there. It's just, for the love of God, man, stand up for yourself. Shoot some of these people preemptively instead of being like, I'll shoot you, I'll shoot you, I will, I've done it, I'll do it, I've done it, I will, I will, I will. Put them down, stop it, stop passing them to each other, stop checking to make sure there's bullets in them, stop making sure that they're oiled and cleaned, stop, no. It's like, dude, just fucking shoot them.
Yeah, it's like the one time he pulls the trigger to defend himself or to save anyone, you'd swear it's entirely by accident.
Yeah, and like, I can see how this could work. Like, he's clearly an idiot. He's clearly a coward. You get to that moment, he finally has to make that choice. And it's like, no, he finally realizes and owns up to the fact that he is in a post-apocalyptic hellscape. Morals mean nothing. Survival is all that matters. But he doesn't actually become that guy immediately after.
No.
It's not like he comes around the corner after. And he's got like a Rambo headband around his head, like fucking Weird Al in UHF, and just blows everyone the fuck away. No, he's still an asshole.
Oh yeah, no, like he never ever becomes that hero character. Like, This is the movie where I'm looking at your lead character and going, why are you not dead?
Yeah, how did you bumblefuck your way through this? If we got halfway through this film and he died and suddenly any of the women became the main character, that would have made more sense. And that's totally a more modern way that film would progress.
And with the Lenore Zahn,
it's like,
JJ,
it's just
that
there.
Almost happens.
Oh, you can see it. Yeah, the plot literally tries it. And then the other half of the plot goes, no. One, we can't end that soon. Two, this is 1985. Get back in the kitchen. And it's just,
yeah.
Oh, we were so close to the film that this would be now.
Oh, yeah. And but also quite simply, I'm gonna say it. Walker, the military misogynist pig that we mentioned earlier, should not have died. Because
it would have been entertaining if he was the one who became the informant. You know, like the prisoner, I can't remember his name, the guy who's paralyzed and then gets a stake shoved into his face.
I think Boomer.
Yeah, Boomer. It would have made sense if somehow, like, I know that that would interfere with, like, Gideon finding out and knowing about the crew. And I love that he knows who they are. They don't have to have that exposition. He's just like, yes, I'm the one who brought your ship down for this exact reason. I have a specific scheme. It's not evil. Yeah. It's just selfish. You are a mechanism in my scheme. Nothing more. This has nothing to do with villainy or anything else. I am just trying to survive. And these idiots have somehow managed to be convinced to serve me. So I might as well bring them along with me too. But it's pure just survival driven. It has nothing to do with like ruling the wastes or like being the pig bastard that he is. Those are just, that's utilitarianism.
Yeah. One last thing with Hal, and then we can go right into Gideon because like we need to go right into Gideon. But like having your comedy relief as the main protagonist, just, it does not work. I'm sorry. It just does not work.
Like, it can work, but he's not Bruce Campbell.
No. And this is not a comedy.
Yes, and this is not a comedy. It has surprisingly comedic moments that probably aren't meant to be. Not that the whole thing's like a laughingstock or anything like that. It's solid. But there's a creeping suspicion that at any point in this film, have you ever seen Strange Brew?
I might have seen like bits and pieces.
Okay, we might have to do that as part of this Connexploitation, but the film begins with a film within a film wherein Bob and Doug McKenzie, it's a Bob and Doug movie. Bob and Doug McKenzie acknowledge that this is their movie as separate from like the TV show. And they're going to show you their movie now that they shot for millions of dollars. And it is exactly this. Rick Moranis is wandering around in like a homemade science officer like Spock shirt and has a black Bauer hockey helmet on, and he's just like, the mutants have come for me. The world has ended. Get away, mutant. You know, take off.
Give enough time just to see. Okay.
Okay, then 10 years after World War IV.
2051. No, more.
What? No.
2051, the future.
They saw it already.
Take off. Next century.
I was the only one left on the planet after the Holocaust, eh?
Hey. Go.
The Earth had been like devastated by nuclear war. Like Russia blew up the U.S. and U.S. blew up Russia, eh?
Statue of Liberty.
Psst, act.
Lucky act. For me, I'd been off planet on vacation at the time of the war, eh? There wasn't much to do. All the bowling alleys had been wrecked. So as I spent most of my time looking for beer. One day, I was out looking for a nice place to build a city for my children when I spotted a mutant in the Forbidden Zone. I landed my vehicle to pursue and destroy this genetic freak before he could warn other mutants in the underground caves. I was kind of like a one-man force, eh? Like Charlton Heston in Omega Man. Did you see it? It's beauty.
Yeah!
Fleshy-headed mutant, are you friendly?
No way, eh? Radiation has made me an enemy of civilization.
Alpha Base, this is Bob McKenzie. I've spotted a fleshy-headed mutant in Sector 16B.
Oh, take off, you hoser!
There are so many moments in this serious version of that
where
it's like, it could have just turned right over into, oh my god, it's the mutants. Take off, eh? You hoser.
Oh, yeah, no, there's moments here that could have easily been that famous Troll 2 line. The
oh, my God.
Yeah. Oh, but yeah. Oh,
I love that.
Gideon Hayes, and I have to give a shout out to Kevin King, who played Gideon Hayes here, because
he's fantastic.
This was possibly the best performance in the movie.
Sleaze.
Oh,
terrific! A terrific portrayal of B grade sleaze in power. A literal, like, teenager who, just because he is a little slicker and a little smarter than the dumb shits around him with guns, he was able to convince them to make him leader, even though he's literally a schoolboy.
Yeah.
And he's more obsessed with his would-be girlfriend than, like, the survival of his new civilization.
Oh, no, he has just this perfectly written arc where he is just so convinced that he is in the right, that his plan is always going to work, and his hubris. Anytime he encounters an obstacle or any sort of personal downfall, it's his own hubris, without fail, every time.
Oh, every time. And, like, that's the thing. This is one of those wonderful portrayals of a would-be dictator. It is someone who is otherwise nothing. Like, nothing. There's no way in hell they would ever allow this person near any kind of power. But because of, like, circumstances and bastardly decisions, he is now in charge. And he's nuanced and layered as someone who truly believes he's not a bad guy. He's just in circumstances that are requiring him to make decisions. He even offers a gallows, like, reprieve.
Yeah.
An open gallows reprieve for, like, anyone. Any of you can live right now. You can survive. You just have to, you know, like pull the cord on the other ones. And I will let you go. I'll even give you some supplies. And whereas most villains, you'd assume, oh, no, he's just going to kill you after that. I actually kind of believe him on this. Like, I'm pretty sure he outwardly afterwards says, oh, I would have just killed you. But it's just like, would you have, though?
Yeah.
Are you saying that now because they defied you? He's very Homelander. I know, I keep coming back to The Boys because I fucking love The Boys. But, like, he truly believes that if I do this nice thing, it doesn't matter how bad I've been. You'll go along with it because that's what I want. And so long as you just give me what I want, everything will be fine.
Oh, yeah. Literally, my one and only complaint with this character, and this should tell you how much I love Gideon, because this is such a tiny, tiny complaint. There's no way in hell that guy wastes a steak like that.
Yeah.
No way.
Like, no way. I was expecting him to get him to eat it and then be like, it's pretty good, huh? Yeah.
It's your buddy.
Yeah, I could totally see that. Or when Boomer won't agree to what Gideon wants, Gideon just takes a plate and just starts eating the steak in front of him.
Yeah, yeah. Not throw it on the ground and then throw him into it. Which, like, yeah, it's a great fuck you. It's a terrific fuck. It's a slow build fuck you.
Yeah.
Like, throughout this whole thing, it's like, you know, it's dinner time. We're going to actually cook you the steak. At no moment is there, like, you know, like, yes, they throw it in his face and, like, rub it around. But, like, you kind of do get the sense, like, okay, you are actually going to allow him to eat this. And instead, they just kind of, like, make a fucking mess of it at a point where, like, everyone is running out of resources and people are getting sick and dying. It's like, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. No fucking way is that an actual venison steak or even just, like, cow. No, I just wish this had that line where it's like, were you really going to feed him a steak? What? No.
Yeah.
A That's from that guy. Remember last week? Yeah, no, that's from that guy. Don't worry. We got lots of it sitting around, and I'm not going to fucking touch it.
Oh, yeah. And on the other hand, that consistency, of like, at one point toward the end, they're on a sailboat. They're about to make their escape. And Gideon tells everybody else to hand him their guns. Because he's like, oh, we don't need them anymore. And his random generic guards hand over their guns. And he's just calling me like, yeah, you know what? You guys have been great. It's been a pleasure working with you. Bang, bang. And then pretty much as soon as that happens, that's when things start to go wrong, and House starts in on what may be one of the worst rescue attempts I've ever seen.
No, it's perfect. Everything goes perfectly, I tell you. All of that was according to plan.
Oh, it's perfectly how? It's terrible for anyone with common sense.
Oh, yeah. No, and again, like, this could have been played as a comedy very easily, even just, like, with comedic elements. I don't feel like it was supposed to be that funny. It was hilarious. It was wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
But the climax of this certainly does happen. It's just like, wow, okay. You went from 0 to 60 and only hit the brake when you hit the wall. The wall, of course, being a truly wonderful moment, because, like, to jump ahead just a little bit, the good guys get away. They get in their sailboat and they float off, clearly inspiring Zack Snyder. This was the template.
Well, actually,
just like,
if you really, I was just gonna say, if you really think about it, maybe not just Zack Snyder, because I don't know if you remember the ending of another movie that we had reviewed a while back, Red Spring.
Oh yeah,
where you switch out post-apocalyptic nuclear wasteland with post-apocalyptic vampire explosion. And it's the same. We have our two main protagonists trying to get to this sailboat so they can escape to safety. It's kind of the same ending.
It really is. Before I forget about it, we should definitely talk. They managed to. Okay, so first of all, Gideon notices a thing.
Yeah.
And it's great because by now you've also forgotten about the thing. And the thing is, at the very beginning of the film, about 5 to 10 minutes in, one of the nuclear weapons arms itself. And you get 60-hour countdown. And they don't revisit it much.
No,
they want you to forget about it.
Yeah, oh no, they never know. I think Hal wasn't able to launch it, but he was able to set the timer for as long as he could.
Exactly. So it's like, okay, we have to get to the whole movie has a deadline that wants you to forget. We have to get to a boat to get the fuck away from here in 60 hours. And it intentionally makes you forget it. It does by not reminding you. It doesn't give you clock updates after a certain amount of time. And it just goes, ha, you've forgotten it. And then after all of that happens, they manage to escape. But it's like the bad guys aren't dead. That's weird. Usually by now, the bad guys are dead. And Gideon just goes, what the hell is that? As he notices the nuclear bomb that is not supposed to be in the payload. It's not like, oh my God, it's a nuclear bomb. It's just, what the hell is that? Isn't that supposed to be empty? And we go to stock footage of a nuke going off. And it's just,
oh yeah.
Okay, maybe this was intentionally comical. Because that's fucking hilarious. And as our heroes float off into the sunset, a title card that comes up that says something like, the nightmare is over, civilization is saved. It's just like, yes, boys!
Yeah,
maritime safe again, you can come on back!
Mankind has finally achieved peace.
We nuked Halifax. You can go fuck yourself now.
Yeah, no, but like as much as you say that we were supposed to forget about that nuke, I didn't.
Oh, so good. I did. And with the man, he was like, "What the? You know, like the minute he Dr. Nicked, what the hell is that?" It's like,
yeah, I'm sitting there for like the entire like final 2/3 of the movie going. Like, at every exterior shot where you see the remains of that space station, I'm sorry, that nuke, it's
right. And that's the thing, center. It's right there. It is, and no one mentions it. The characters don't go, oh god, we have to get the fuck out of here because of the nuke. It, like, becomes a background reason.
Yeah.
Aside from, like, everything else. But you're right, it's literally there. It's on screen. All the time. And suddenly all I can picture is Chekhov riding a nuclear bomb like in fucking Doctor Strange of
Yeah, it's like, I'm sitting there, I'm going, okay, you have finally broken into this capsule. You have no doubt pillaged the supplies. You have emptied out everything. You have searched every square inch of this thing for anything of value. And, okay, Gideon, I love you, but you missed the giant fucking nuclear missile. You're only seeing that now?
How the hell did you miss a nuclear weapon, you dumb piece of shit?
Come on now.
Imagine his arrogance if he thought he had, like, a nuke as a toy. Oh my god. So well done.
But I do have one question though, because I think there was something that I missed, because there's the point where Hal and Vinny hop into our favorite front end loader to chase down Gideon and JJ on the sailboat. And Hal swims out to the boat because none of this makes sense, but it's Hal, so fuck it.
No, listen, it's the greatest chase scene in history. Killdozer versus maritime fishing vessel. Who will win? Who will win?
We now return to Night Boat, the crime-solving boat.
Faster, Night Boat. We've got to catch those starfish poachers.
You don't have to yell, Michael. I'm all around you. Oh no, they're headed for land.
We'll never catch them now.
Incorrect. Look, a canal.
Oh, Night Boat, go!
Oh, every week there's a canal.
Or an inlet.
Or a fjord.
Quiet! I will not hear another word against the boat.
Okay, TV off. It's family time.
Oh, but Marge, Night Boat! The crime-solving boat!
Like I said, how jumps in? Hal gets onto the boat and confronts Gideon. Mm-hmm. I completely lost track of Vinny.
Yes.
I have no so idea what his fate was.
I am pretty sure he either gets shot, blown up, crushed, or the script simply erases him. And he fades off like fucking Marty McFly.
Okay, so basically maybe I didn't actually miss anything. Okay.
Yeah. It would have been funny if there was a post-credit scene where, like, he just opens the door to the fucking crapper and, like, pulls his pants up, and it's just devastation all around, and it's just him. All alone.
The sad thing is, I could buy that more than I could buy Indiana Jones in the fridge in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Yeah, no, that's because a good maritime outdoors crapper is she can withstand any kind of brutal force, be that inside or outside.
Okay. So, and one other thing that I think needs to be discussed, because Again, I have questions.
Yeah.
Specifically, the gallows scene we mentioned earlier, and when they finally, when most of our heroes finally escape, it comes down to Boomer somehow, and folks, keep in mind that Boomer may or may not be quadriplegic. It seems to depend on which scene he's in.
Yeah, I mean, like, he can't move his arms, but he can breathe on his own. So,
but then he can move his arms in order to drag himself somehow sneaking through the entire population of this encampment, which normally I would have a problem with that, but in this movie I can go, yeah, sure, why not?
I personally, I felt that just needed like a moment, like a tiny little scene, specifically during his stake torture.
Yeah.
When like they leave and he just like moves one arm to get the meat. And it's like, ah, okay, you are paralyzed, but you've convinced them that it's worse. Like, you're only paraplegic. They think you're quadriplegic. You still have the use of your arms. You're just trying to lure them into a sense. Like, tiny little detail. Sorry that the film is only an A and not an A plus.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, like,
get back in the study hall.
Boomer, I had no problem with. But like I said, he gets himself to a position where he's able to shoot Gideon, hits him in the leg. The chaos is what allows Hal to finally escape, get back to Vinny's hut, grab guns, and pretend that he's capable of staging a rescue. Okay, fine. Now, where I had an issue of confusion is the aftermath of that with Gideon and Jordan, where Dr. Jordan goes to operate and treat Gideon's leg wound, and she goes to inject him with something, presumably for the pain. He instead grabs the needle, injects her, and she ends up dying. Apparently, potassium can kill you.
It can, actually.
Really?
It can send you into a coma. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Potassium overdose can actually, like, essentially shut your... Part of what it can do is essentially, like, put you into a non, like a coma. It can shut down parts of your body. And it's like, it's not that it will kill you. It'll create a situation where you will die. Kind of.
Okay. Like. Okay. That makes way more sense now. Because when I was watching it, I'm sitting there like, did he just kill her with vitamins?
It can essentially, like, practically lower your blood pressure to useless.
Okay.
Yeah. So like it's one of those things where like, okay, that is a technically competent and smart thing to do that as you see will leave an audience going, what?
Yeah.
Okay. You could have just said it was anything else.
Yeah.
You know. Or like you could just give him a triple shot of opium and sent him off to the suite hereafter. But no, like someone in the writing room, Paul, I'm looking at you, probably had a fun fact, and it ended up being used in this scene. And it's like, yes, that makes sense. I don't know if it is as fast acting when injected directly into your bloodstream as Gideon, you son of a bitch. But it will possibly kill you. If you Google the dangers, like a potassium overdose, it says right at the top, seek immediate medical attention.
Okay, cool. I'm good. That makes way more sense now that I know that.
Yeah, it fun details in science.
I mean, I shouldn't need a medical degree to understand a plot point, but again, fuck it.
Especially in this movie. But it's nice that, like, instead of doing something stupid that made no sense, they did something smart
that made no sense at the time. Yeah.
Isn't that nice that it wasn't, like, just some fucking bullshit?
Oh, no, it was at the very least creative bullshit.
And that's what this film is. It is delightful, creative bullshit. It's, and I say that lovingly. I really enjoy this. As I said before, like, I'm a massive Fallout fan. And this is right within, like the Fallout canon. This is if you need more, if you constantly crave that narrative, like me, by all means, dive into this. You will really have a great time watching it. And if you are a local, you'll have a lot of fun picking out. It's not necessarily that it's like, oh, you know, they shot that downtown and that's this building and that's this place. It's not like that, but, you know, for the most part. But it has elements where you're like, ah, yeah, no, I totally know people who would be those people if this place became a radioactive hellhole. I know that guy.
Oh, yeah.
I know you.
And, I mean, it is also quite simply a radioactive hellhole with product placement.
Mm-mm. And I'm sure Keith didn't pay fucking shit for that. Maybe they donated some beer to the production. Chances are more likely that that was just what the crew was drinking.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, it was probably just like saved bottles or something.
Name something more Nova Scotia.
Or, yeah, and there was a couple of times where I saw, like, a Montreal, what looked like a Montreal Canadiens toque on somebody, which is appropriate as hell for around here. And I think Montreal at one point somewhere in the 80s actually did have a farm team somewhere in the Maritimes.
Yes, if I recall, the Citadels were the one of the farm teams, along with another one that were overtly appeared to be the Canadiens. And that was at the same time that the St. John's team was the farm team for Toronto. And so, fuck yourself.
Okay, yeah, if it was St. John's, then I think Fredericton would have been the Montreal team you're thinking of.
Yeah, that seems about right. Yeah. Good times with 80s local hockey. Is there anything else to say on this?
I don't really think so. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed this, and I know, like you had mentioned a few times about how this would fit into Fallout. I kept watching it. I watched it, and I kept thinking, if you told me that this movie was in the same world as Mad Max, I could believe that. Like, that is perfectly viable headcanon.
Yeah, this is the same world as Mad Max. This is the same world as The Road. This is the same world as Postman. Once again, underrated classic. Trust me on this one. Trust me on this one. Watch and read The Postman. at some point, I'm going to make you do that. We're going to fucking watch The Postman. Extended edition.
But until then,
threats and promises. Threats and promises. Challenge accepted. But we're not doing that right now. We're not doing that next week. Next week, what the hell are we going to watch?
Well, next week, we'll be continuing Canucksploitation with specifically Canucksploitation of Canadian film credits as we watch Thor, Love and Thunder.
Listen, there are three countries this movie was filmed in. One was Australia. The second was New Zealand. The third is Canada, specifically Vancouver, British Columbia. That is one third. That is legally CanCon. Therefore, Thor is Canadian. You're welcome. Heritage Minute, please.
Oh, and people think that there is no benefit to taxes.
Arts grants, people. Arts grants. They're delicious.
Like, I'm sorry. The logo of the Government of Canada is at the end in the credits of pretty much every Marvel film.
It's
this works.
Fantastic. And if you are interested in seeing me essentially just gush for an hour and who knows how long at the feet of Taika Waititi, by all means, like, share, subscribe, tell your friends, leave a comment, send us an email at realgeekshfx@gmail.com. And you, yes, you can join us in this cabaret, this cavalcade, this celebration of brilliant, inane stupidity that we call B-movies.
With next week specifically, if gushing about Taika Waititi is not enough for you, let's be honest, half of it will be gushing about Taika Waititi, the other half will be about Natalie Portman's arms.
That's right, it's a double long episode. Oh, Taika! Oh, Nat! Oh, Taika! Oh, Nat!
Also on a completely unrelated in any way note, other than the fact that I got to get this in somewhere one last time, please also remember vote.thecoast.ca. Just log in, go down to Music and Culture and scroll down to nominate us for Best Podcast in the Coast Magazine's annual Best of Halifax campaign. Again, even just getting on the ballot would be a huge benefit to the show. And frankly, this show winning Halifax's Best Podcast this early would be goddamn amazing.
Yeah, this early. Episode 130, who the fuck knows? So early.
Let's be honest, in terms of audio podcasts, we haven't really been doing this that long. We just have a lot of content that we can recycle and fake it.
Yeah, I hope you people like the Wednesday episodes, because you're getting them until July 2023. And I'm not fucking joking. Until then, check out our Wednesday episode, which will be out tomorrow as of your listening to this enjoyment. And check us out on Thursday or Friday or any other assorted day when we're going to have B-roll. Hopefully, please, God, Ezra Miller, don't do anything. Fuck off.
I am so tired of talking about Ezra Miller.
Yeah, I just want one episode without them. I just want to talk about trailers. I just want to talk about movie trailers. Bless. Here's hoping. We'll see you then.
See ya.